Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Good morning. It's Craig here from Sharp Knives. It's Knife Talk, and I'm joined, as usual, by Mareko Momasi of Momasi Fire Arts and Jeff Fader of Fader Knives. He's back. He's been resting all week after his operation last week, bless him. And he's back. We are here every Monday morning to talk to you about knives, answer your questions, and just generally have a laugh. We hope you're all well. We are Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. If you've got any questions for us, please DM us there, Knife Talk Podcast. So, guys, how are things? Jeff, let's start with you. How are things?
I'm fine, you two bastards.
What's
obviously.
The problem?
What's the problem? I heard your podcast. I heard that you said that I had a hair transplant. Not only was it just a hair transplant, it was from my pubic hair to my hair. So I had a readjustment from my pubes. My hair, I had full of pubes now.
Nice.
So
nice.
That's, thank you. Thank Is you.
That was, for me, that was a deep callback from In Living Color. I think they did a skit where they were like a fake advertisement for a hair transplant. It was all from pubic hair.
Ah.
And so everybody had these afro, like these tiny afros. It was hilarious.
Living Color was good. That was the introduction of Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for Jim Carrey, we wouldn't have, Living Color. I don't know if we would have gotten as much Jim Carrey as we did.
Yeah.
I did not have hair transplants, ladies and germs. I mean, that was, you know, but fine. Everything's fine. Craig, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good, actually. Yeah, all good. There's nothing to report here. The sun is finally out. I had my little one's birthday this week. It's been busy, but all good. Everything's positive. Everything is going as it should.
I remember when Buddy was born, and you were telling us all about it on this podcast. The crazy thing is, when Mareko and I started as your co-hosts, Your first set of kids weren't born. So
I know.
Throughout this whole
It's been three since,
Since the beginning of this show, you get to, we're actually watching the lives of your children.
You guys hone me up every episode.
Hey yo. We horn you up. Get the pubic transplant, ladies and germs.
Yeah, 2 years. He was two this week, and he's like a four-year-old already, though, you know? But time is just flying by, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's totally crazy.
Yeah. He's so cute.
He is, to be. And he is, he's a smiling assassin.
Yeah.
He's like people say, you know, boys and girls, you know, the difference, you know, biological and all the rest of it. He is just all boy. He just wants to climb everything. He wants to hit everything. He's got a temper. It's just like, whereas the girls, they've just been sweetness in light since day one, you know?
Well, obviously, there's too much estrogen in your household. You need to, like, get a little, you need to interject a little bit of, you know, testosterone in there. He's overreacting. But he's overcorrecting.
But he's got
himself.
Enough for the two of us.
Oh yeah, boy. Yeah. That a boy. Yeah. That a boy.
But no, all good. All good. I said the sun is out and everybody just seems happier. Everybody you meet, everybody you come across, it seems as if any weight has been taken from their shoulders and everything seems good. So it's been a very good week.
Nice.
Mareko, how are you?
I'm good. I'm getting ready for the Travis Wurzhammer. And actually, by the time this airs, I'll have already come and gone and done my demos and stuff. This past week, I've been working on getting materials together to take down there. I'm doing some forging demos. I'm doing some grinding and pattern development demos. And actually, when this episode comes out, I'll be at the Desert Metalcraft School doing, Principles of Material Flow, as well as decoding Mosaic Damascus. So it's just all about understanding how material works or how the material actually flows and how that affects patterns, and then using that knowledge to better plan patterns as well as reverse engineer patterns. That's about it. Coming up to so much is happening in such a short period of time. I'm going to be in Eugene then, like 2 weeks later after that, after I get back.
Who's Eugene?
Who is this Eugene? You're going to be in him. Have mercy, baby.
Eugene, Oregon.
Oh. Okay. You're like, oh, wait a second. Hold on. It's turned into a different kind of podcast.
Eugene Levy. I'm going to be down at the OKCA show. I'm excited to get down there because I'll get to see Don Nguyen. Well, I guess I'm also going to see Don in Arizona, but Jeremy Spake. JD Smith is going to be at that show. Ben Tendick. There's a bunch of great guys that are going to be at the show and people I haven't seen in a long time. And I'm really excited about that. And if anybody hasn't been to the OKCA show, it's like basically the longest running, largest West Coast show going back to like the 80s. And people come to that show and exhibit there from all over the world. But also, it's an interesting mix because it's not just custom makers, but collectors of vintage and antique knives. And there's also kind of an educational aspect to it about knives and history of knives and different styles of knives and stuff that are kind of like a school science fair around the outside perimeter of the space. And so, I don't know. It's really cool. It's a lot of fun. I'll probably be taking the kid with me, too. And so I'm excited for that coming up pretty soon as well. But otherwise... doing good.
Before we started a recording, Mareko and I were talking, and it kind of jogged my memory. You were talking about to this morning you were having a kind of business meeting.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a topic. There was a topic I kind of wanted to bring up that I think that we, as you know, business people, knife makers, and stuff like that, we gloss over. We gloss over. And a lot of it is we get a lot of questions to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram about collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had Riley Kirkpatrick on Full Blast, and we were talking about his collaborations with Meat Eater, which is this very famous hunting and kind of cooking organization. And he was saying that they're not doing a collaboration, but it took a long time to kind of create a relationship.
Sure.
And yesterday I had my business partner Tony was down, and we're trying to. This is a little bit of a slow period. This was a slow period last March too. At the exact same time, we're still doing okay, but it's definitely a slow period. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to get ahead by trying to reach out to do more collaborations with other chefs. We're bringing that back, something that Tony's been wanting to do for a long time. So we're working with four different chefs, and we're at various stages of. Is this going to work or not? A lot of these guys don't get back to you. This takes a long time. And what was interesting was I was talking to Tony, and the same conversation I was having with Tony was I was having with Riley, which he was just, Tony was saying, look, these connections aren't immediate. You have to see them as something that can take a long time. Like, we're working with this one very famous chef in Philadelphia, and I've been fooling around with him for like 6 years. Mm-hmm. And like, some things happen and some things don't. We're kind of circling back to kind of create this organic relationship to have some sort of collaboration. And one of the things that we get a lot of on Knife Talk is, questions from the listener is, the chef wants to do a collaboration and I don't know if I should do it or I should give him a knife or something like that. And it's almost as if there's this expectation that there's going to be an immediate return on investment. And I think that we should probably discuss the fact that that's not always the case.
Well, isn't the value Well, I hopefully, you know, you at least break even and make a little bit of money. But isn't the value with in collaborating with these chefs and do these limited runs is the advertising or kind of the brand awareness and exposure to their audience that you're creating through this kind of cross-pollination of I guess, crafts?
Well, the way we see it is more like it's about the long game. Like, sure. We're here for a long time, and there might not be a return of investment for a while. And when Tony and I were talking about it, I was like, ah, this goddamn guy, you know, I've been fooling around with this guy. I've given him some knives and I've helped him with some charities and stuff like that. And he's done a couple posts. Mm-hmm. And he says, he said to me, you have to see it like you're planting a seed. I have a relationship with this guy now. Now that guy called me up this morning at like 7:30 and we had this really nice conversation that we wouldn't have had if we hadn't been dealing with, I'm talking about his father just died and we were talking about that. And we're creating these organic relationships, and it isn't just the fact that everything is going to be an immediate return on investment. Mm.
Sure.
Go ahead.
A lot of that, I think, is building trust as well. I think,
yeah,
by building this relationship, you get to know each other a bit more,
right?
And there's a certain amount of trust that's going to be built over time. Whereas I think if you just reach out to a chef cold, or if they reach out to you completely cold, it's always a bit of a shot in the dark. And I think it's a bit of a red flag actually if a chef reaches out to you.
Mm-hmm.
I think by taking your time and having these conversations, you're definitely building trust between the two of you too.
Well, here's an example. We're working with four different people. By the end of this, when this comes out, probably maybe five. Some of them might not work. Some of them might not work. I sent an oyster knife to a guy. Allison told me to send an oyster knife to a guy, and you know, it's like almost promotional. You know, and we haven't heard a fucking thing from him. And I'm just like, okay, that's just the way it is. You know, we do write these things off. But at the same time, it's just like some things are going to hit, some things aren't going to hit. And I think that we need to be a little bit more flexible in terms of the idea of experience and understanding that, you know, when you reach out to a chef, you can for a collaboration, what you're trying to do is you're trying to force an organic relationship. It's almost like going on like a fucking blind date. You know, it's almost like you're trying to create chemistry. And in business, I think that we're knife makers. I think that sometimes, especially our listeners who are going to part-time, the full-time, they're a little bit on the cheap side in terms of thinking about the long-term investment of creating these relationships and these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I think it's a bit more of a risk on behalf of the chef as well, because generally you're going to be reaching out to people who you know have a good reputation, which is why you want to reach out to them, because you know whether they've got a following or whatever it may be. And quite often they wouldn't know who you are. You're just, you know, I'm a guy who makes knives. You use knives. It would be great if we worked together. So, you know, with regards to like the risk side of things, you know, it's you can understand why chefs would sort of steer away from things like that. But as Jeff said, if you know them, you build up this relationship first before you have that conversation. It's certainly better.
That's the hard part is about all the stuff we deal with, especially on this podcast, is there's this real intention of immediacy. There's this intention of like perfect example. I mean, Mareko got shot out of a cannon when he went on Joe Rogan, and he created a relationship with this guy. But I mean, I think that those kinds of situations are few and far between, and they're awesome, and the fact that you can kind of capitalize on them is amazing, but it's not going to be it's not the rule of thumb, you know. Kinds of situations are rare, and I think that a lot of our listeners are hoping for that immediate, you know, giant bump from a hit from something.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just not the case.
Well, I think you do it the right way, where you're talking about it's a long game, and you're developing this relationship over time. And I think one of the biggest challenges that came with being on Joe Rogan is being in a position to do something with that visibility. And I definitely was not really like prepared to. I didn't have a bunch of knives like ready to sail out the door or anything like that. It all came together like really last second, and so I just kind of went on there on a whim, and it was good.
Can you talk about that, Mareko? How that came about and what it meant for you afterwards and the rest of it?
I tricked him.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
There you
okay.
Go, ladies
no,
and
I said. yeah. No, I was getting ready to go work with Neil Kamimura for the first time in Hawaii. I was living in Connecticut at the time, and there are layovers between like either LA or San Francisco or Seattle or Portland, whatever, before you actually go to Hawaii. There aren't any direct flights from Connecticut. So I was like, well, shit, if I fly through LA, maybe I can build in some time and I can at least go visit Will Brigham, but maybe try to connect with Joe Rogan. Because at that point, he had already purchased four of my knives. And so I didn't have any plans to really be to stop in LA except for a layover. On my way to Hawaii. And so I reached out to Joe and I was like, hey, I'm going to be in LA. And I didn't say for how long, but I said I was going to be in LA. And if you're interested, because he and I had talked about the idea of me coming and just at least just visiting him and showing him some sharpening stuff, just some basic stuff, but not, we didn't talk about the podcast or anything like that. And that was kind of my toe in the door. And then he was like, yeah, that would be cool. And so I was like, all right. So I started booking stuff and made plans to be in LA. And then last minute, he's like, would you be interested in being on the podcast? And I was like, holy shit. Yeah. And I was so, it was so, I was so unprepared and discombobulated by the whole thing. Like it was just before Jeff and I, or just as Jeff and I were getting ready to join Knife Talk Podcast. And I completely fucking forgot to even mention Knife
you
Talk.
Fucked that up. This was right, the same time, right after I did that Epicurious video. And I had brought you back your knife from that Epicurious video, and then you called me up to say you were going to be on Joe Rogan, and I said to you, if you need help preparing, I'll help you. Whatever you need, you know, whatever. And, you know, you did your thing, and you also were nice enough to wear my hat on the podcast, which was cool. And I remember how nervous you are. I remember how nervous you were beforehand. I remember when we talked beforehand, you were like, you're a little bit nervous.
Super nervous. But like I said, I kind of lied to him. I don't know. I wasn't completely true.
Yeah, you didn't lie to him.
I did say I was going to be in LA. It's just like the layover is typically like two hours versus a couple days. So anyways.
You think that everything is like work. Everybody's got to know every goddamn detail.
No.
Who cares?
No. So yeah. So he invited me to do the podcast and then all that kind of lined up very last second as well. I also did some other events as well as working with Will Brigham. And so I ended up spending a week in LA before finally getting over to Hawaii and working with Neil for fucking a week or 2 weeks, or I can't remember how long, before finally heading back to to Connecticut after that trip.
That's taking advantage. I mean, you didn't take advantage of a situation. I mean, you had to create a relationship with Joe Rogan beforehand.
Yeah, for sure.
And it wasn't just like this kind of, I mean, I think that one of the things that we all see a lot of is somebody sends, I mean, her perfect example, Allison now is sending messages to, you know, she goes on Instagram and she looks at people that she thinks that we would be aligned with and she sends them a message. And then some of them work and some of them don't. And we've recently done a guy who's just, you know, I got to cough something up for this guy, but I'm just like, I'm slightly rolling my eyes about it. But at the same time, I got to send two, Allison wants me to get her two knives to give to these chefs down in Philly that she knows that she really likes that are going to be helpful to us. And I'm just going to, you know, I got to take a little bit, you have to take advantage of some situations, but it's not, I might not necessarily, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm going to get all the money back. I mean, it's just like, I'm trying to plant some seeds.
Yeah. Call it your marketing budget.
Well, it's like, I think that we get to the point where I think that we're all very cheap, you know, and I think that the hardest part is coming up with this concept of full-time versus part-time, and you all of a sudden you see the numbers and we're being very conscious of the fact that our bills have to be paid. But there also should be this concept of what's the long-range plan? Are we comfortable with the status quo, or do we want to grow in some situation? And I think that that's the one thing that I don't hear a lot of. We get a lot of calls about, like, oh, this guy screwed me, and, you know, I thought it was going to be good. Or this guy wants a free knife, fuck you. And it's like, but at some point, you know, we got to climb out of whatever hole we're in at some point and look at the horizon.
Yeah.
So, and then what else? That's a...
Before we get too far along, I think we should give some shout out to our friend Joyce at Cutty Knives.
Yeah,
she was just featured in the spring summer issue of Savoir magazine. So did like a feature. They even threw in they have her mom, one of her mom's recipes of food, but it's really cool. You guys should go, people should go check it out. Get the, either get the magazine or you can go check out her Instagram page, Cutty Knives on Instagram. It's the first post right there. That's, and it's pretty rad.
That's the only magazine, food magazine in the United States worth a damn.
Dude, when I travel, that's, I stop at the Hudson News, and that's what I always grab is a Civil War.
That's the only one worth a damn. And they were, I don't know if they're coming back or they were out of business and they're coming back, but in terms of food magazines, that is the only one worth a damn.
It's really good.
Really good. So congratulations to our, our friend. And she listens every week, by the way. Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Joyce.
Okay, let's get on with the show. Before we do,
Combat Abrasives makes the world's best abrasive belts for knife makers, available in any size at unbelievable prices. Go take a look at combatabrasives.com and get 15% off with promo code KNIFETALK15. Do it now.
Now, before we get into questions, I know you guys answer a lot of questions. We still have, we have a ton of feedback and we have a ton of red flags. So just be aware.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Well, let's start with some questions, then we can head into them. Okay. Wilder Knives of Alaska. A customer orders a special knife for their sons. Brit Mila?
It's a ceremonial circumcision.
Oh, right. Okay. Was it Brit Mila?
Yeah, that's you. That's you. You're Brit Mila. Come on, Brit Mila, keep answering the question. Read the question, Brit.
Should you make it? He's offering a lot of money, but would it be sanitary? Would that be considered a medical device? Could there be legal implications if things go south? Any thoughts? Take the money or no way. Take the money, but charge by the inch.
Hey, listen, if it's a child's foreskin, it's not going to be that much. Jesus Christ. Brit Mila.
That's funny. I mean, I feel like it. If you're creating a wound of some sort, you should do some sort of work to clean it up afterward, right?
I don't necessarily refer to that as a wound. I mean, it's a surgical procedure.
Yeah.
I mean, cutting that dick off. I mean, not the dick, but the tip of it.
The schmeckle?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very good. Very good, my boy. Okay. Very good. The tip of the schmeckle.
I wouldn't be comfortable, personally.
Why not? What, you only make serrated knives?
Yeah, make it out of Damascus. Make it out of stainless Damascus.
What are you worried about? What are you worried about?
Without getting too sort of political and stuff about it and, you know, people's religious opinions, there's other. I don't know. It just seems a bit wrong to me.
Are you kidding me? What if you were vegan, would you make a knife for a meat eater? Who cares?
Who cares? Meat and there's like, you know, your son's meat. It's very different.
Hey, Brit Mila. Back off, Brit Mila. Brit Mila Kunis, relax. Jesus Christ.
I wouldn't want to feel responsible for any extra pain that anybody went
through.
Wait
a second.
Put it that way.
It's not like you walk down the street and you find a guy and say, hey, you want to do a Brit Mila? You have like professionals. You're just making the instrument that they're going to use.
No.
But they'd have special instruments. I would have thought they'd have special instruments for such a specialist job.
I got to look this up.
We have listeners.
The easy out for me would be, I don't make that kind of knife. Sorry. You know, and I'm out.
Wow. That's so weird. I mean, what's the difference?
Like,
who cares?
A little scalpel.
Yeah.
Almost.
There's
like
people,
a fucking butter
I know
knife.
We have listeners who make knives for cutting their own children's umbilical cords. What's the difference?
Well, they're fucking weird too.
Well, I mean,
there's
you know.
No difference. There's no difference.
I actually inherited some knives from an old Moyle, and Moyle is one of the religious leaders in the Jewish religion that do the old the old bris, and some of these fucking knives are big, which I'm just like, well, I don't know why it needs to be that big. Jesus Christ. But, I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with it. I mean, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I would, in terms of the cleanliness of it, if I'm making stainless steel and I was, you know, they got to clean it too. It's not like they, you know, spit shine it before they all cut the old dip tip off.
Rub it on the elbow.
Get when your butt elk's on it.
Get on your butt before you fucking cut it off. You don't do that. But, I mean, I wouldn't have any problem with it. I am kind of slightly surprised that Britt Mila Kunis over there doesn't want to do it. I mean, who cares? What if they didn't tell you?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, even so, sure, they'd tell you. They wouldn't just say, can we just have one of your knives, then just go and just cut somebody with it. Surely.
How do you know?
Well, if that's the case, fine. If they want to use like an 8-inch chef knife to do it, run away with it. But I wouldn't, knowing what it's to be made for, I wouldn't. I'd be out immediately. I'd be like, no, it's not my thing.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like a painful thing for these children. I mean, it happens all the time. All right, we don't have to talk about it anymore. Fine.
Yeah,
I can tell.
Let's not.
You're uncomfortable with this already. All right, Britt Mila Kunis. That's the name of the show. Britt Mila.
What about you, Jeff? Would you do it?
So you two would,
of course,
you'd be all over it.
Yeah,
of course.
I would say,
I would say, yeah, it sounds no problem. Whatever. I don't want to know about it. Yeah. You know, like I remember when my daughter was born, and I said to my wife, "Look, I'm here from the neck down. I'm not watching the baby be born. I don't want to see all the blood and the guts and all that. I don't want to know about the... I can't even look into a person's mouth. I want to know that shit is magic. I don't want to know." So I said, Hillary, I'm here from the waist up. From the waist down, I don't... And then the guy and the doctor says to me, "Do you want to cut the cord?" I'm like, "Do you want to pick me up off the floor? how about you do your job and I'll do my..." I wasn't like that. Yeah. But I was just like, "Yeah, I'm good, thanks." Because in my mind, I can picture what the sound of cutting the umbilical cord is. It's like this kind of, and I was just like, "I'm gonna throw up." So I'd do it, but don't tell me about it.
It's like cutting a rubber tube.
Thanks. I assumed. So
what would it be made of? Anything special? What are you doing with this? Stainless steel.
I would make it out of damaged steel. Actually, I'd make it out of damaged core, so it had that clean core material, so that there wasn't any irregularities from the pattern along the cutting edge. So it's just a nice, clean cut.
I would think they'd have to stabilize or sanitize it in a certain way too. So maybe the scalp, because scalpels, I don't think have scales. You know, I think that you'd have to do it. It'd have to be like something that would be in like an autoclave or something like that.
No, it would be like one of those monolith style knives, like a Ben Cologne style.
Yeah, Ben Cologne. Yeah.
Yeah. Or also, what is the Slacksmith has been doing those all metal knives as well, right? And Oliver Goldschmidt as well.
What Super about the cool. guy who forges knives with his hands? Maybe he could make one.
Oh yeah, he just slapped the steel with the shape.
Yeah, this is for Bismillah. This is for the Brit Mila. All right, we've done enough. We've said enough.
But if you want to make a Brit Mila out of Dharma steel, head on over to dharmasteel.se. We're joking, but actually, it's if you are making a special knife, it is the stuff to use. Beautiful, beautiful stainless Damascus. Lots of beautiful patterns. You can go online and look at the patterns and see them there. And you can get a discount. If you use Knife Talk at checkout, you'll get 10% off. But go take a look at their stuff, and also Dharma Steel AB on Instagram. You'll see the kind of stuff people are making with it. It really, really is special.
Mm-hmm.
Hot tip.
So to speak.
Nice. I'll take this next one. Yeah.
Hot tip from Eugene.
I'm going to take this next one from the...
Let me just write that a second. Hot tip from Eugene.
Oh, my God.
Okay, there we go.
All right, I'm taking this one from the bottom of the list because some of the questions get buried a little bit. But this one's from...
I just say one thing before you go on?
Yeah.
To the listeners, we really appreciate you sending us messages. And then more and more, they're getting longer and longer. And I'm asking you, please, to edit yourself. And then a lot of you are also responding with, "I'm sorry it's such a long novel, but I'm not really sorry." If you want it to sound good, keep it edited, because the side talk, it just becomes hard for us to read it. And then, you know, like, I don't want to read the next one because it's too long. So.
All right. This next one's from Jacob Dotson. He says, "Hey, guys, got a question for the podcast. I've been forging some knives out of Damascus and 80 CRV2 and for some reason, while I'm forging them, they have tons of surface fractures and cracks on the edge. Is this because of overheating, working too cold? I haven't had this problem before. Any advice would be appreciated. Thanks and love the show. What do you guys think?
No idea. I mean, cracks is cracks. So
yeah. Yeah, to me, this is coming from experience and actually with learning how to forge damaged steel. So anytime you start adding alloy elements like chromium and other kind of whatever, other stuff, or the carbon content gets really high, that brings down the melting point of the steel. And so that's why manufacturers are trying to strike this balance. And if you're forging this stuff, you got to make sure that you're keeping it in a particular range. If you can, ideally have a thermocouple of some sort that you can read the temperature of your forge with. Because what happened when I was first learning to forge damaged steel, I did not take that into account, the high carbon content, the high chromium content, and how that affects the melting point of the steel. And it brings it down substantially, or especially compared to just like a conventional 1080 steel or something like that. And what happens is when the material starts to melt, it doesn't just turn into liquid instantly. It starts to partially melt, and it always starts at the weld, but the grain boundaries of the steel. And so you start to get kind of this kinetic sand. And I went through probably 12 cubic inches of damaged steel, which adds up really quick for anybody who's worked with it. They know how much it costs. Yeah, that was probably easily over $1,000 worth of material before I finally got a thermocouple set up in the forge and understood where the different temperatures were in the different in the forge, because it wasn't the same temperature all over. And then being careful, because the material then also has for kind of more boutique material like the damaged steel, you have a short forging window. What's nice about most of the carbon steels is they have wider windows to forge in. But again, when you start adding those alloying elements like chromium, it makes the steel very difficult to forge, both honestly while it's hot, but especially when it starts to even get a little bit cool around, like just like even just a nice orange color, it feels like you're hitting a rock. And so Crew Forge V does this, ADCRV2 does this, 52100, again, these steels that have these additional alloying elements, especially chromium, 52100, D2, they're all hard as shit to forge. They're really tough steels. Obviously it's doable, but it takes a bit more work, and you have to be more careful about the temperature range that you're working in. So my thought is that is what is happening, is that the steel, you're running your forge too hot. For me personally, I actually like to run my forge on what's typically considered the cooler edge of the forge welding and forging range, which is around 2100 degrees. But when I worked for Bob Kramer and a lot of shops, other shops I see, people are ripping. Their forges are running it for a blacksmith would be considered white hot, which is probably closer to 2500 degrees maybe, which... If you look at I can't remember the diagram, but the diagram that shows like austenitic range and all that kind of different stuff, and that melt point, it's getting close. Even though it's not fully into the melting range, you're starting to do stuff to that steel that it doesn't want to do. I've even done that kinetic stand thing with Crew Forge V. It's a chromium, or it's a high carbon steel, but because of that chromium element, it's not even a ton of chromium, and because it's a higher carbon steel, it wants to bring down that melting temperature. And I just put the steel in the forge. I thought it was doing good. I wasn't too worried. I thought the temperature was well below any melting range. And I pulled that thing out in the first squish, it started to crumble. It looked like kinetic sand. And so you just got to be careful of those temperature ranges, because they can really mess up your material. And it, yeah, especially if you're buying your steel, it's a really sad thing to lose that.
I had a Pat Quinn on. I'm going to have Pat Quinn on more regularly, and we're going to be doing blacksmithing questions. And one of the questions he answered by saying that one of the biggest mistakes that a lot of blacksmiths make is that they're working the material till it's too cold. So a lot of times you'll see he'll see blacksmiths, and I'm talking about blacksmiths, not bladesmiths, but it's the same, can be, you know, you can transfer it over. Is your work, you should be working in a very consistent range. You know, you shouldn't be trying to forge while it's red hot into orange hot and it, all the way down to black. When you get down to black, I mean, you are potentially making potentials for cracks, but you're not being as efficient as possible. So he says, I always tell my students to work within the range of when it starts to go to orange or lower orange, put it back in. Yeah. So that also could be one of the things that a lot of bladesmiths are doing, is the fact that they're just working things from too hot to too cold, and then they could be introducing stress fractures.
Yeah. I will say that when I'm forging, I will forge often until the steel looks kind of basically black, but it's probably still at a dull red, which is around 1,000 degrees. But as the steel cools, the way I'm hitting changes too, so that I'm doing my major forging while it's still glowing. It's incandescent, and I can see light. You know, it's bright. It's glowing. And so, but as it gets colder, my forging hits are lighter and lighter and lighter. And at that point, I'm really, more than anything, doing a little bit of corrective work, so that I'm not throwing a banana back in the forge. But I'm not really doing any massive or intensive cross-sectional compression in forging when it's really cold. And you'll see people forge, quote-unquote forge, when it's cold, but ideally they're just doing a little bit of light corrective forging. But they gotta, you know, if you're gonna get anything done, it's gotta be hot, so get it back in the forge.
I mean, that's one of the things that he was saying too, is the fact that you know, bringing it all the way down, all of a sudden you're not working the material at a hot enough range to move it correctly.
Yeah.
And there needs to be, people should be using it. I'm not saying bring everything to white hot, but
no.
Heat management is also part of the efficiency of being, a blacksmith and bladesmith. Mm-hmm. That I don't think we say get it hot and hit it, but I think it's too vague in terms of where we should be going. And with that said, I would highly suggest, and back to what we were talking about in terms of the long game, I feel as though there is a major disconnect with the concept of spending money on equipment to be the sidecar for instead of education. And I feel as though we're spending a little bit too much time and energy on stuff instead of having to learn what the right way to do is. And we're, frankly, I think a lot of people are wasting a lot of time. What do you think, Craig? You there?
I'm listening. I mean, everything that you said completely makes sense. I got nothing to add, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think, Bracco?
Yeah, I think I can't remember. Maybe we were talking about this last week. I can't remember, or maybe I was just talking with a friend about it recently. But I think a lot of people are a little heavily reliant on having every single tool. And I think the reality is you can get a lot of work done with a very simple setup. But what's really important in making that happen and to advancing your skills is to get a lot of practice on them and not just rely on getting another tool. I can do a lot of really good work with my knives with very simple or very few tools. But that comes with time and practice and learning my craft, right?
There's also a hesitancy to invest in your education.
Oh yeah, sure.
I see that all the time. Yeah. People are, you know, I'm not saying refusing, but they're more likely to buy something shiny and new than to say, you know what, I bet I could learn how to do this better if I took a class at New England School of Metalwork.
Yeah, I got you.
You know, yeah, and that's the crazy part. That's one of the things I find to be crazy. Is that the amazing thing about these schools now, Center for Metal Arts and New England School of Metalwork, is they're offering so many scholarships.
Yeah.
So it's not like, you know, it's too expensive. I know it takes a lot of time and energy, but I feel like there's this, people want this jump in the what they do and how they work, but they're unwilling to say, all right, let me go to the professionals instead of, you know, just freeballing it for a while and getting the stuff that I don't want really need.
I think a lot of that is because it is a practical skill. It's a skill that you learn by doing. It's not the kind of thing where maybe you're sitting at a desk where you'd expect to have some sort of formal education in. What we do is a practical skill, and you know, for every one person that says, you know, go and get some more education on the subject, there'll be another person who'll say, just start hitting and see right. Where you go, you know?
Well, yeah, that's true. All right, let's get to the next question. Don't forget, we have feedback and red flags. So the next
question... Okay, well, before we do, more thing.
Knife Talk is sponsored by Evenheat, the manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com.
Okay, sorry.
Wait. I'm sorry. Alpha Blade and Forge says, I'm a part-time maker and I have a second knife show coming up. Most of my knives are stock removal 1084, and since my company is a passion project instead of a source of income, I've kept my knives between $110 and $180. It doesn't leave much room for profit, but it allows me to recoup my material costs and some money towards shop upgrades. Last year at a show, I had people ask with concern why my knives were so cheap, and some even asked if something was wrong with them. I also feel like this could be perceived as a fuck you to my fellow makers at the show since I'm a fraction of their price. Should I stop striving for a sub 200 price point or keep my prices available for everyone that's trying to get a knife on a budget. How would you feel as a maker if I set a table up next to you at a show? Thanks for your amazing content, gentlemen. So he's going to a show. People are telling him he's charging too little. And, you know, what do you think?
That's an interesting one.
Yeah, it is interesting.
If he's selling his knives, I mean, it's that whole thing of it, you know, it's supply and demand. So if, depends how you think. I mean, he's already said that this is his... He's a part-time maker, and he's not really looking to get income from it. But, you know, generally people are. If they start making money from something, they want to make more money from something.
Right.
So it's a case of, if let's say you're making, I don't know, 5 knives a month as a part-time maker. I don't know, however many you may be making. If they're selling immediately, that may be a sign that maybe you should put your prices up. I say should. I mean, there's no should about it, really. It's completely up to you. But generally, people would then think, okay, well, these are selling really quickly. You know, I could afford to put my prices up a bit more. And then you gauge it to see when they stop selling. That's generally how people, you know, do business. But as a part-time maker, and you know, and you've already said there, you're not really looking for profit. And yeah, nobody is to tell you what you should charge. If you're happy and you're covering your costs...
Yeah, but he's clearly, you know, it's clearly concerning to him that people are saying what's wrong with them.
And there is that perception, isn't it? Yeah. There's certainly a perception of if things seem too good to be true, what's wrong with it, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, if he's not doing this as a business and he's not really worried about, you know, the lack of income, of, you know, from that small percentage of people who will feel that, well, fair enough. But with regards to if I was at a show... And he was next to me and selling knives, you know, extremely inexpensively. I'd like to think that I wouldn't be irked by it, but I probably would be. Just because it's if you're in a business environment, you want to do as well as you can. And if somebody is, effectively undercutting you on the next table, you would feel a bit irked.
And he comes up to you at the end of the event. Hey, Craig, how'd you do? I sold out. You only sold three?
Exactly.
But then,
yeah,
you know,
so you would feel it. But that's just the sort of competitive nature, I suppose, you know?
Right.
Nobody can tell you that you should.
Not saying that that's what this guy's doing. Not that he's just trying to, like, go up to everybody and be like, I sold everything, you fucking, you guys are too expensive.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think?
I do appreciate the concern and you know, that thought. But, you know, you do your thing. Don't let anybody tell you what you should be doing.
What do you think, Mareko?
Yeah, I agree. You got to do what's right for you and what you're comfortable with. And ultimately, while people might want to point fingers, like what you're doing has nothing to do with anybody else. And neither does what they're doing, unless they're literally walking up to your table and like telling people not to buy your knives. What they're doing has nothing to do with your work and what you
literally got. None of their business.
Yeah, it's literally. You just happen to be in the same place. I actually did a show a few years back, and I was there with only one other culinary knife maker, and they were the table right next to me, and their work, all of their work, was at a set price, all the different pieces they had, and mine were like a couple thousand dollars more. And then the people that were attending the show were walking by, seeing my table first, and then going to the next guy and seeing his work, and they're like, they don't understand the difference. And I think part of when it's only, what is it? I think it's a Seth Godin book I read a while back. I can't remember the title of the book. I love that I keep giving all these book references.
Yeah, by the best. I read this book yesterday. What the fuck was it?
No reference. Seth Godin is, almost anything Seth has written, though, is really awesome. But anyways, he's talking about, like, if it's only the price point that people have to compare your work on, they're always going to go for the cheaper price. And so by giving people more, which is where we've talked about and touched on, like, around branding and marketing and telling your story and giving people something more to want to buy than just the product itself, then that idea of too high of a price or too low of a price doesn't really matter, because people are ideally coming to you because they want to buy from you and not just buy a knife or whatever you're selling. And I think... Yeah, I think it shouldn't really matter what people or other people think that your knife or your prices are too low. I do think that there is some weird sales psychology that I still don't quite understand, where people, if they see a price point and they have somewhere, who knows where on the spectrum, but they have a price point that they think a certain level of quality work exists, and if it's below that, then like these people are saying, they're like, well, what's wrong with it? And I had to try to learn that early on, because I felt like this weird, like, shame around charging, you know, over $1,000 or $2,000 for a knife. But when you're putting all this high level work into it and then it's $800, people look at it and they might be scratching their heads thinking, you know, why? That seems kind of low. But I don't know. And then that's subjective. It changes from person to person. They all have their different meter gauges on what price point things exist at.
I would highly also be skeptical of business advice from knife makers, including us. I mean,
true.
A lot of these guys are winging it, and they have, I don't know what I'm doing attitudes with, I know what I'm doing prices, you know? And I think that, you know what I'm saying? It's like, I hear these dudes fucking, I'm winging it, but then the prices aren't winging it. You know, they're like, all of a sudden, they're like, they go from a dork to a PhD when it comes to the fucking price at the end. So I get very concerned in regards to getting advice from a lot. I remember when I first started, a knife maker I really respected just said to me, you can't have a business with as a knife maker. It doesn't work. It doesn't work for you.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, I find myself getting a little, you know, I definitely have gone up to people when I see their work and in awe and say, you know, you could really raise these prices. I know that I've done that. I know I'll be like, and I don't think I've said these are so cheap. I'm like, I usually say these are a really great deal. And, you know,
you're not doing that to justify your own prices.
No.
You're doing that simply because you think they could get more money for their work.
Yeah. I usually refer to something as being fair or not fair. But at the same time, it's like, once again, I know knife makers, they may do a great job. They suck at customer service, or they're not good at business. They're very good at telling you how they want it, but they're not good at telling you how they're going to give it. And I just, like, I get very, like, hesitant when I hear business advice from knife makers. You know what? Fuck it. Not us included. Fucking not us included. We're still here, bitches. This is 6 years. Every week, giving you good shit. So
I looked up the book. I found it. It's called All Marketers Are Liars.
There you go.
It's a really good one. And then another one is This Is Marketing. Both of those are by Seth Godin. They're really good listens.
Cool. Yeah.
Cool.
Do your thing.
Sorry?
I said do your thing. I'm sort of talking to the listener. Do your thing.
Okay. Do your thing. Yeah. Good advice. Speedster Stoves says, greetings. Quick question. Have any of you considered any form of non-destructive testing of your blades?
Sure. Cook with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what do I got to do?
Use them.
I strapped some TNT to it, and then I fucking pushed out the plunger and run away.
Yeah. I that's a weird one, any form of non-destructive. Because I think destructive testing of your blades is basically taking it to the limit and seeing how far it can go before it will break.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, with regards to testing blades without any destruction, yeah, I'm sure we all cut with our blades, and the three of us cook a lot with our own stuff. Yeah, and that's advice that we've given from the beginning, actually, isn't it? If you're making culinary knives, for example, you should be using them in the kitchen yourself, and you know, and seeing how they work. If you're making knives for the field, you should be using them out in the field, that kind of thing. But yeah, I'm sure. I think it's a bit of a weird question, actually. I thought everybody would be testing their blades in some way.
I think we also as custom knife makers, or without, you know, isn't there truly a guild, or is there truly a school? We sometimes judge culinary knives off of factory culinary knives. And I recently got a knife back that I made 5 years ago, this guy and his wife never sharpened the knife. Never sharpened the knife. They threw it in the dishwasher a lot. I think I sent you guys the picture.
Yeah,
It was like, I mean, I never seen anything like it, frankly. But at the same time, I took care of him. I was amazed at how sharp the knife still was. Never being sharpened, being used, being thrown in the dishwasher. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the way we heat treat is different than the way that a lot of factory guys heat treat.
Sure.
A lot of, like Wusthof and all those guys, they're heat treating at a very, they're much softer knives, so it's easier to maintain. These kind of higher hardness stainless steels, they hold a better edge. Period. I'll get some back, and I'm surprised at how long they maintain.
Yeah, well, I've had, you know, batches of hundreds of knives go for heat treat. And when they come back, I mean, there's been loads that I've rejected, for example. So I think when factories are doing heat treat, they're doing them in massive, you know, bulk numbers. And they're generally heat treating for the masses, you know, where we're heat treating for something quite specific. So we're doing, you know, one-offs or small batches. We're trying to hit certain numbers. But yeah, my experience is using factories to do heat treat is just throw a bunch in, and when it comes out, if it's hard, it's hard.
Hey, know? Baby. Tell that to Eugene.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think just the fact that we're doing smaller numbers means that we take a lot more care for each process along the way. So it's not just the heat treat, it's every single process along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Cooking, I mean, especially for culinary knives, using them is the best way to get a feel for how they're cutting, if they're wedging or whatever, and how to if the grind needs to be adjusted. Otherwise, the only time I've done destructive testing is mostly when I've been pissed off about something or how something turned out. And so I test it out and I just beat the shit out of it. And it does surprise me how durable a knife can be at such thin cross sections. But I will say that if anybody's knife is coming back busted the fuck up, it is definitely abuse. There's a certain threshold that knives really perform best under, and once people have gone past that and into obviously like chipping and breaking, they've done something wrong and twist and fucked it up. But then the question is, I mean, and I know Jeff has done great with his customer service and taking care of knives. I mean, I've done the same too. Knives are all fucked up. And sometimes you just gotta, ideally they're few and far between. So you just gotta take care of them. I think
you got to take care of them. Got to.
With regards to destructive testing, I've seen like other knife makers using like chef knives on 2x4s. And, you know, I'm doing some, you know, destructive tests and see how good the knife is. I'm looking at it, I'm just thinking, if it is doing well on a 2x4, it's not going to do well against a tomato. You know, because they're completely different things. Yeah, I don't quite totally understand what they get.
Yeah. That is a very good point.
What the hell are they getting out of doing that? It's, if anything, it's proving the opposite of what they want to be proving, you know? Mm.
That is hilarious. I never, ever thought, yeah, that's 2x4 is great. I'm not eating 2x4 tomatoes.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. You're just going to squash totally a tomato. Different. You're not going to slice it. Yeah, yeah.
It's hilarious.
You don't got teeth like a wood chipper?
Yeah. You know what? The crazy thing is, and I think, you know, we've also, we may have a part of this is, you know, we've started this podcast. Well, Craig started this podcast, had us on. We're three culinary guys, you know, and I think that we've been, you know, quietly, we should have kept our fucking mouth shut. We should have done something. We should have done like, you know, the Brit Milov knife show and talk about just cutting dicks off. But because I mean, there is a change in the way people make knives where they're making more culinary knives because they know that the demographic is much higher. And the people who are making culinary knives don't cook. And then when I say don't cook, that means they don't even cook dinner. No. When I do cut tests, I'll chop an onion here or there, but I'll cook. And then if I can cook without thinking about the goddamn knife and make dinner and I'm just enjoying it, but I'm in like a flow state, or I'm just cooking and I'm not being like, this sucks, I'm not micromanaging and I'm forgetting that I'm even using a knife. That to me is a successful knife. You know, I don't try to like, you won two cuts and okay, that's fine. But if you can cook through your meal and all of a sudden dinner's done, I think that that's a good test too, where it's not driving you crazy. You know when a knife you don't like. You know maybe it's too long, maybe the handle's too round, maybe that, you know, it's
everybody's
uncomfortable.
Everybody's got a favorite knife in their drawer. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But I think that's the biggest issue that most guys have is they don't even, and I don't, you don't have to do tweezer food, but just, you know, cut a sandwich once in a while. You know, make something.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jeff, tell us all about your grinder.
Oh, baby. I got a couple.
Oh, baby.
They all come from Eugene. They're for you. No. I got two Broadbeck Ironworks 2x72 grinders. Damn right. I love these goddamn things, and that's the slug line. I love these goddamn things. And if you go to BroadbeckIronworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you're going to get 10% off everything. I love the chassis. I love the fact that you can go horizontal and vertical. I love the fact that they make different attachments. They are knife makers making very intuitive grinders and attachments for you. Even if you don't have the Broadbeck chassis, you can retrofit these things. So go to BroadbeckIronworks.com, put the promo code KNIFETALK10 for 10% off everything. So we have listener feedback. We also have red flags.
Let's do some of that.
The first listener feedback comes from Jeff Fader, and he says, I heard last week's episode on firework, and I cannot believe that you guys both do firework while the knives are hardened.
I don't do any firework.
I know you don't, but you guys were saying that if you did, you would harden the knives first and then do the firework.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, let's hear it. School us.
I've done, I'm not schooling, I just, it seemed like, when I first started to do it, it was because I was working with Matt Paul, and he was doing the file work, and he would just heat treat, you know, regularly. And I had heard from other knife makers in regards to, well, when you start to make some of those lines, you're making these potentials for a stress fracture. So I did, because when I started doing the stainless steel is so goddamn hard, I was just like, there's just no way, you know, that I can do. And I started doing the file work beforehand. And actually, when I started to make knives, and my first heat treater was Kyle Daly, I would send off the knives with, I would do the file work before he heat treated him, because I just didn't think I could get through the 440C. Of all the file work I've done, I've never seen, and we're talking a couple thousand knives at this point, I've never seen a crack from the file work. So, I mean, I can imagine it happened, but I mean, never even dawned on me that would be a thing. And then when it comes to the file work, I also go a little bit deeper than I would normally, because I know that I'm going to take a little bit off the top when I finish the handle.
Right.
Off the spine. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I always do it after heat treat, because it's literally the last thing. So the handle is normally on. So I've got good references to, you know, how it's going to look and where it's going to be, that kind of thing.
Right.
But yeah, but that's good to know that you've never had any cracks or anything like
no,
that. It's never affected the structure.
I have had cracks on handles of knives, and I believe that it was from a specific batch of steel. Like, I was having very similar, and I also changed my heat treating recipe to Laren Thomas's range on knife engineering, and his ranges. I mean, if you ain't using knife engineering for your ranges, you're playing, because he's got all the ranges in the back. I've changed all my recipes, and I used to have such huge problems with AEBL, heat treating AEBL, and then I just, you know, I started using his recipes, and I've been having very, very good, results. Nice. And I haven't noticed any cracks from the file work if you do it before the heat treating.
There we go. Have you tried file work with a rotary tool?
I am hesitant to use rotary tools in general, because that what you had said on the podcast is they have a tendency to skate, and it is really super hard to like get yourself in a position to hold them and then it not going berserk and riding down the road all of a sudden you're on a fucking skateboard going down the spine. So I tend to try to stay away from the dreaded Dremels, and I have a actually Mareko used my monster. Remember my rotary tool?
Yeah, your die. What was
the die grinder? Those things are deadly. Those things are deadly. But I don't. I tend to not use them.
Didn't I break that thing accidentally?
Yeah,
it's going a little hard.
You
on
gave it.
It
a little bit of you gave it a little chiropractic adjustment. It's fine.
Oops, sorry.
It's fine. Yeah. But that was
okay. Cool. Any more feedback?
Yes, we have feedback from our friends at Falcon Knives AK. Guys, if you want to listen to us, give us some feedback or red flags, go to Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. Knife Talk Podcast on Instagram. This one comes from Falcon Knives AK. Hey, guys, lots of talk about hand sanding, and it always boils down to the fact that it just sucks. Just a little tip that I've found to help. Go to your local big box hardware store and grab a couple of free vinyl floor samples. The vinyl flooring is waterproof and easy to cut. You can cut them into small sanding sticks, and you have a hard side and a soft paddle side. Beats making sanding sticks with strips of leather. Take it or leave it. It works for me. Take care, Kurt Camiotti.
Interesting. Kurt.
Nice tip.
Yeah,
love good. Kurt Camiotti.
Yeah. We don't get many good tips. That's a good one.
We get good tips. The question of whether or not I read them or not.
Oh, you're keeping them to yourselves?
Well, I mean, some of them I don't know. We actually have, that's right.
You're hoarding
that's right.
Tips.
My whole, hey, baby. I give them the old Brit Mila, whatever you want.
Cut that tip.
Get that Brit Mila out of here. All right, Brit Mila Kunis. This one comes from Ryan Brewer. Good episode as usual, gents. A little feedback on the last question about the Jesswine ultrasonic tool. Remember we were talking about the ultrasonic tool a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
As Mareko figured, a linear stroke tool for polishing, baby. I mean, I added the baby part. It is designed to use hard EDM stones for polishing molds in injecting molding industry. It's extremely useful for polishing tricky geometry and features and small features where regular hand sanding would be impossible. It won't speed you up on a flat blade bevel, though. We have more ultrasonic devices. This one comes from Michael. Hey, guys, quick feedback regarding the guy who asked about using a handheld ultrasonic device for hand sanding. At my job as a tool and die maker, I use these machines all the time. They're expensive, slow, and break all the time, and are overall shit. So pretty much it's the same as these fucking Dremels. Have a good day. On a serious note, they do produce a very nice mirror finish, but it takes about 4 or 5 hours on a 1x1 piece of carbide metal. Starting from surface finishing that the EDM leaves, and the diamond pastes are painfully expensive. They cost 70 euros for 5 grams, which would probably last for one, maybe two knives. So let's, maybe it isn't for us. That isn't for us. EDM tools. That's the problem. We're also trying to everyone's trying to reinvent the wheel. It's like,
oh, looking for shortcuts. Yeah.
The most important part is kind of understanding what you're doing. It's you're just trying to. You have, you know, grits are, you know, you got high peaks and low valleys, and your low valleys are where you don't want to get. And how do you cut that back?
With Indasa Rhino Wax,
girl,
which you can get from TexasFarrowSupply.com. They've got all the grits you could possibly need. We all use Indasa Rhino Wet. Saves you time, saves you money, and we can save you more money. Heading over to TexasFarrowSupply.com. Fill up your cart with everything they have. They've got everything you need as a blacksmith, knife maker, whatever you want to call yourself. They've got everything you'd possibly need. Use Knife Talk 10 at checkout to get 10% off everything. That's including your Indasa Rhino Wet. What are you waiting for?
What are you waiting for? I'm waiting for Benjamin Angeloni. Benjamin Angeloni says, first off, I want to say thank you for all the talking about your struggles and the more heavy topics lately. I've had my own struggles with mental health, and my knife making is one of the things that keeps me going. Hear you guys talk about real issues really means a lot to me, and I'm sure others. Also, Craig can relate to having someone bare their soul and having to stop them to run to the shitter. So no judgment here. Though I did laugh very hard. Thank you for all you guys do. Yeah, a couple episodes ago, I was getting all deep, and then Craig stopped everything because he had to take a fucking massive dump. That was a highlight level, and we kept it in.
You know, I kept it in for the longest because I knew we were getting deep, and I said, I can't go now. Because it just looks terrible. Got to the point where I was sweating, and I was just like, stop, I'll be back in a minute.
That was really a high wire act. That was a high wire act. And, I kept going because I kind of knew, you don't have time to do a ton of editing. It's just like, I knew we could just keep the ball rolling, and it worked out great.
Yeah.
Jean-Philippe says, a few episodes back, Mareko was talking about his struggles with perfectionism and mistakes. Mm. My own experience with the same issue really held me back in my development. After pondering the issues, the conclusion, perfectionism isn't something that really exists, but rather an illusion. Despite this, the foundation of my mindset is to always strive for perfection. I know that I won't achieve it. Rather, I'll try to cherish the imperfections and the opportunity that they give to improve my work and myself and others. Sorry, not sorry for the novel. Yeah, well, the funny thing about Jean-Philippe is I asked him to... if you would edit it, and he may have taken two words out. he's like, okay, how about this? I think he took an is out. I mean, it's just like, you know, help me out here, guys. Well, we can keep going. We could do red flags, whatever you guys want to do.
Let me just fit one question in between that. Question is right at the bottom there from @Jordan. Bros, he says, I've got a question about sharpening angles for chef knives. What angle do you all find to be the best for a workhorse chef's knife, and why? And love the show. We've had this question a few times, and it always sort of confuses me a little bit when people give sharpening angles. It's generally thought of between sort of 15 and 20, isn't it, for a sort of a kitchen knife? 15 being on the more delicate side and 20 being a bit more sort of rugged, I suppose. But that's always as if it was a single bevel, if that makes sense. So when you're looking at a double bevel knife, which most chef knives would be, the actual overall angle is double that, isn't it? So let's say you're doing a 17 degree. It's actually a 34 degree, if that makes sense. You know, it's always hard to sort of get in your head what angle you're talking about when you.
So you're talking per side. So when you said
per side,
yeah, when you said 15 degrees earlier, you're talking about just for one side of a double bevel.
Knife. Exactly, as if it's a single bevel with one straight edge. Yeah. So when people say, you know, 17 to 20 is quite normal for a chef's knife, they mean per side, running from a right angle. That sort of, I think that makes sense. Yeah, but I remember when I first started, and I'm reading through stuff, and I'm thinking 17, and I'm sort of doing the math in my head. I'm thinking, Jesus, that's super, super fine. But yeah, consider that's only half of the one side of the blade. The other half is the matching angle again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, with regards to angles, I mean, what do you guys look for? Is there anything specific, or do you just do what feels right and keep using the knife until it feels right? I mean, as a generally for me, I generally try and get about 17 on a sort of standard workhorse chef's knife. Mm-hmm. Jeff, what about you?
I hate those. The geometry of my knives has changed even up until, you know, a few months, you know, 6 months. They're constantly evolving.
Yeah.
And the angle really, the angle of the bevel doesn't do you enough information if you're, the thickness of your spine and the distance from the thickness of the spine to the edge is depending on the size, you know, depending on, there's a lot of factors. There's a lot of factors involved. I try not to do, I know that for years, thin to win was where it's at. And my problem, you know, where everything is almost down to like a fucking razor blade. I had to make a decision that I wanted my knives to be maintainable by non-professional people. And the geometry of my knives changed. The spine's a lot thinner. I push it a lot farther, but I also like to have a little bit of material behind it. So it's not like, you're not trying to sharpen a razor blade. So like I have a little bit of material behind it. It's probably like, I don't know, we're talking maybe, I guess it's like 13 degrees, something like that. You know, I'm pretty tight on there, but I don't have an exact number.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So before you put on that final edge, do you generally have it like a set angle you take it down to? Do you take it down to a wire?
Like I need you guys with the fucking thousand, the millimeters and all that stuff. I don't have a fucking number, but I know it when I see it. And I'm pretty much as long as it's even and it's like a, I hate to even like make a suggestion in regards to what it's like, but it's a very, very thin, even line. And then I go and then I put a very thin edge on it, but I don't want it to be, sometimes I don't want it to be too thin of an edge. Like that's the thing is a lot of guys will, you know, you make it down to nothing and then you put the tiniest edge is what matters. And that's generally not the case with chef knives too. Like you need a little bit of, you know, you need a little bit of, Mareko, would you answer this question?
It needs to hold this question, Mareko.
I don't have the words for all of this.
You're good. I can't promise. I don't think there's a right answer. Honestly, I think it comes down to personal use, and honestly, for every person that uses a knife, it's going to vary slightly. For me personally, I'm sharpening to an overall 20 to 5 degree bevel, which is 10 to 12 and a half degrees each side when I'm sharpening. But that is for a knife that that's going to somebody that I know is going to have, because with a thinner edge, it's a lot more delicate, right? So somebody who has the knowledge and experience with either owning other handmade knives with thin edges and going to take the care to be able to maintain that. If it's a knife that is going to, what I would call a workhorse knife, honestly, I would probably still keep my sharpening bevel very similar to that overall, like 20 degree bevel, 20, 25 degree bevel, but I would leave the edge a little bit thicker. So it's more robust. It has that extra meat behind that cutting bevel to withstand any kind of different impacts and stuff that might accidentally occur when, you know, cutting through, you know, cutting through vegetables and fruit and boneless meat all day is pretty straightforward. But if you're starting to use a knife, and designing a knife to be a workhorse that can also be used for breaking down chicken and filleting fish, or even gutting fish and breaking down fish fillets, you start to run the risk of that edge coming into contact with harder material, and with that you want a little bit more edge or material on your edge to kind of support that cutting edge when it comes into contact that like that. I might even beef up my geometry depending on again who it's going to or how it's designed to be used, to like 30 degrees overall, which is 15 degrees each side. To me, that feels like a really beefy edge for the way I'm making my knives. And that way I would, and as well as beefing up the blade geometry, the thickness of the material behind that edge. When it comes to sharpness and cutting ability, Dr. Laren Thomas has a great article on his Knife Steel Nerds website. It's just knifesteelnerds.com, and the article is called Sharpness Versus Cutting Ability. And essentially, he goes through all this testing, and he's playing with different edge thickness and sharpening bevels and all this stuff. And essentially, it comes down to... even though a thinner edge at a more acute angle, I think he did the testing with the same kind of steel throughout, just so that was the same thing. The only things that were changing were the thickness of the edge before sharpening, as well as the sharpening angle. And the thinner, basically, it was thin to win to continue to stay sharper longer, even though it might dull a little faster, because when you sharpened at a more acute angle, you have less of that material to behind that edge, that leading cutting edge to support that edge. But because it's thinner overall, it will continue to cut, at least in his cut tests, longer than something with maybe a little bit more robust of an edge. So I kind of use that as my guideline for how I've decided to sharpen my knives. But again, yeah, typically my knives, when I'm sharpening them, are, I guess, my range is 20 to 30 degrees, and then depending on how hard of a use knife is it versus how gentle somebody's going to be with it, it kind of indicates the angle that I'm ultimately going to sharpen at.
Well, I think
there we go, Jordan. No obvious answer there. It depends, like many other things, I suppose.
I think we've been helpful enough.
I think so.
We got to spread it out, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, what else have we got? Before we do that, I'm going to tell everybody all about maritimeknifesupply.com. Lawrence is a good dude. He's set up the one-stop shop for knife makers. Steel belts, handle materials, tools, forges, kilns, more. Anything that we mention on the show, basically, he'll get it in stock. He's also the Canadian distributor for combat abrasives. He sells Rhino Wet as well. Basically everything you need. He's got it all. MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. There's always a deal on belts as well. For every 10 you buy, you get 10% off. But go check him out on Instagram too, Maritime Knife Supply. And you'll see, you know, he's always putting up, you know, new stock that he's getting in, that kind of stuff. So yeah, definitely worth a follow. But yeah, get your stuff at MaritimeKnifeSupply.com.
We have some good red flags if you want to read some red flags.
Let's do it, yeah.
All right, so a red flag, and if you're listening to this and you want to send in your red flags, are something that you hear or feel or see from somebody else, and you're just like, you get burned by it, and then you remember this red flag, and you're like, I'm not going to fall for the banana tailpipe again. So this first one is awesome by our just a dynamite guy, Henry Hyde. Henry Hyde says, I got a red flag for you. I had a collector who had a lot of well-known makers' work sign up for a custom. I figured, no problem. I gave him a time frame and updates on when I was going to start and how long it would be. The lesson is to not let someone's collection of expensive knives trick you into thinking they'll pay in a timely manner, or at all for that matter.
Oh, geez.
Wait for payment to process to ship anything you aren't willing to lose. I knew exactly who it was, and he confirmed that I was 100% correct. This is like...
I have a feeling I know who this is, too.
Yeah, I probably do think you know who this is. So this is... There's a lot... The best part about a red flag is it's a learning experience, an education. And then all of a sudden, it's just like, I'm not going to fall for that banana in the tailpipe again. Pierce Bingo Kendall. Do you guys want to add anything to that about, you have any thoughts or stories or?
Yeah, I think sometimes people maybe have a reputation that you think, and you know, you put extra trust in. But I think if you just have a set rule and treat everybody the same, you wouldn't get burned, maybe, you know? And it's one of those things. It's a learning experience, I suppose.
Yeah, I've had people kind of feeling the pressure from people to get something sent out while a process or a payment is being processed and stuff like that. And I feel that pressure and I'm like, oh yeah, maybe I can't, whether it's a returning customer or somebody who has a bunch of knives from other people, I always wait for that payment to come through. And to keep it from being personal about that person in particular, I make it about the post office or the platform through which the payment is coming through. So if in case any, I don't ship before that payment comes through in case, cause it would be fucking horrible for the knife to be out there, and payment doesn't end up coming through. And then you have to try to go through claims, with the platform, whether it's PayPal or otherwise, or fucking chasing that person down because, like, potentially they fuck you and they got away with getting you to ship the knife before they actually sent payment, or they sent a bogus payment and you're out all that work. For me, that's like 2 weeks of work, and that's a real kick in the teeth versus and so I just have to be very careful about all of that. And so I always wait to ship.
But the hardest part is like, you know, we don't like the expression, you know, money talks, bullshit walks, is we don't really listen all the time. We get very excited. I know, yeah, that sure. we were dealing with this restaurant and this guy was telling us about all the money. The investors have so much money and don't you worry. And this is what we're working on now. And we're down in some tequila farm going to looking at agave and we'll get back to you. And oh, I can't wait. We're going to order a ton of money. You're going to be swimming in orders. And it was all a bunch of horseshit. And I was like, there was so much bullshit and they were trying to just shine up this fucking dumb story that I was just like, it's too good to be true. I don't want to, you know, have a pipe dream. You know, the one thing you don't want to do is when you go back home and your wife's like, well, what's going on with that job? You're like, oh, don't worry. He's going to pay. Oh, don't worry. You're selling yourself that you're not being an asshole. You're selling yourself that you're not being tricked.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's almost just like, oh, no, he's good for it. I know he's good for it. Don't worry. It's coming. And then because you don't want to believe that you got hoodwinked too. You know, that's the tough one. That's the tough pill to swallow. For me, I don't get too happy. I don't get too sad. I like everything right down the middle. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
And what I find with regards to situations like that, I find the bigger restaurant or the bigger the chain, the more sort of grooming that they'll do with
you.
Oh,
yeah.
You know, and because you believe in it. You'd be like, yeah, I'm along for this ride. But, you know, quite often it's somebody working for them. He was just trying to leverage their name, basically, to try to get some free shit.
And name dropping is the biggest red flag. Name dropping. Oh, I have knives from Jason Knight, and I got all of a sudden. And this is a huge problem in the knife making community. When these guys use your name. So I've had a similar experience, and it might be with the guy that Henry's talking about, where this guy may have used my name to encourage business from friends of mine. So they automatically think, oh, well, if Jeff's work with him, then all of a sudden everything's cool. You know, and then all of a sudden it's just like, I had a good experience, but these guys didn't. So my name gets dragged through the mud. And that, when you start to do that name dropping thing, and let's face it, knife making is not, this is not Hollywood. We are not famous. We're not celebrities. And news travels fast. But then if you know a guy, you know, it's like all of a sudden you're just like, he did business with this guy. He must know it. You know, it's almost like you're vouching for him.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. That's a big problem. Oh, yeah. You work with Mareko? No, that's good enough for me. You know, then all of a sudden maybe it's not good enough for you. Bingo Kendall says, American knife sellers that want to do business with me and sell me knives, all their profile pictures are that same, are the same that every scammer knife count uses. Basically, I think he's saying that, like, these scam knife Instagram pages, all, when you look at their thumbnail, everything looks the same. It's all like the set of five American flag knives with the Damascus and the, you know, the white background, and everything sets, and everything's, you know, it's all the same shit. Let's do this one, and then, you know, we'll see where we're at. Rob McKinnon, awesome guy. Rob McKinnon is a great dude. I want to share this red flag. Always be aware of flattery. It often turns out to be a bad experience. Just my two cents. Thanks, gents. Yeah, flattery is a fucking bitch. I fall for that shit all the time. I love it. Yeah. I'm a sucker for flattery. A sucker.
Yeah.
So, well, what do you guys want to do? You want to keep going, or... I'm gonna do a little after show. Get out of here.
Should we go to an after show?
Sure.
Maybe. Yeah. Okay. Thank you all for listening. We should speak again next week. Okay. What we got? What we watching? What we listening to? What we reading?
I'm heading down after we leave here. I'm heading down to Athens, Georgia, for a long weekend to visit family. So. I'm very excited to sleep on the plane. That's my big excitement is to get some rest on the plane.
Nice. How long a journey is that?
Just a weekend. We're going to visit family for a
little. No, the train.
The plane? I don't know. Three hours?
Oh, okay.
I'm gonna actually suss it out because we're flying into Atlanta. So I'm going to decide if I'm going to. I'm still on the fence if I'm going to run down a Blade show or not.
Mm-hmm. I just remember, did you pay your ABS dues? Did you join the ABS again?
Of course not.
I keep forgetting.
Of course not. I'm fucking every year. If I wanted it bad enough, if I reminded myself, I know that I'm a year late. I mean, I was supposed to. I did it on my anniversary,
right?
So I would remember. I already fucking went past it. So I'm like, I'm already a year out. I'm fucked up.
Yeah.
Lapsed.
Did we do the knife? Talking
about your trip.
Did we do the knife print ad?
We talk about that later.
Okay. Never mind.
So you talked about your journey,
right?
3 hours, and you always say when I drove to the UK, I must be mad. Next Friday, right? So actually, it's the Saturday morning. So I leave France at 9 a.m. I fly to England, where we rehearse all day. We've got a gig in the evening, so straight from rehearsal. So straight from the airport, getting picked up to go to rehearsals. Straight from rehearsals to go straight to a gig. We play a gig. After the gig, I then get a 4-hour coach ride back to the airport.
Oh, my.
For a 5 a.m. flight back to France.
Oh.
So less than 24 hours, I go to England, play the gig.
Wow.
Can't sleep through the night because I'm traveling back. And I'm back. So that's next weekend for me. And I'm like, I'm excited for it because, you know, it's going to be cool. But fuck me. There's definitely no sleep for 24 hours.
When are you leaving?
The Saturday morning.
And then you come back Sunday morning.
Early hours Sunday morning.
Jesus Christ.
I know. Yeah. And not only that, it's like a full day. So, you know, rehearsing for a full day, that takes it out of you anyway. Mm. Then a gig in the evening, and it's going to be our biggest to date. You know, there's like 1,000 people, so it's quite a big one for us. And then straight from there, jump on a coach to take me back to the airport, where I fly back.
Mm. Look at you. You're living the life, dude. Yeah.
Rock star.
No, I'm too old to be living this life, believe me. If I was living the life, I'd be in a hotel for 2 nights to get over the gig. But, you know, this is the cheapest way I can do it, so I'm not doing that.
You'd be high in the hills in Eugene.
Poor Eugene.
So what are y'all I'm sorry I didn't answer the question. What are y'all reading and watching?
We're watching, it's not new, it's on Netflix, The Rookie. I think I talked about it a few weeks ago. It's quite lighthearted. It's about, you know, it's a, you know, a cop, you know, he's a rookie, and but we're now like, I don't know, we must be like 12 hours in now, and it's just got really, really good. So my wife's like, we're watching The Rookie tonight. We're sitting down and watching The Rookie all night. I'm like, oh, I've got two podcasts to do tonight. There's no way. He's like, okay, tomorrow. And he gets some good wine in. I'm making a stay up when we watch the rookie.
What's it about?
So we're excited. It's part comedy. He's a rookie. He goes on, he's out with other coppers and they do their thing, catching crims, man.
but there's like a
funny element to it as well. You know, it's quite lighthearted. It's not quite sitcom, but it's not quite tense drama either. It's just really easy watch. It's all on Netflix, and I'm really enjoying it. Huh. It's really cool, really good.
Yeah. We're in the middle of the morning show of the third season.
Now that's heavy.
It's a good show.
It's a great show.
It's a good show. They're all such repellent people. I mean, that's the best part is like, it's like they have these moments of redeeming qualities, but they're also repellent. So,
yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And the crazy part is the Corey, the Billy Crudup, it's like fucking Tony. So, like, my business partner is that fucking guy. And I even said this to him yesterday. I'm like, you watched the fucking morning show? And he's like, yeah. I said, you're just like that fucking guy. And he was like, I don't watch that show. But he's like, in the face of pressure, he'll make a fucking crazy joke. Yeah. It's hilarious.
Yeah. Wow, yeah. Because he's the main producer guy on the show, right?
Corey. Right, yeah.
Or the president of the station.
But he makes a joke. He'll make a joke. Yeah, he's running the whole network, and then he'll make a joke. Just tons of pressure, and he'll just make a fucking crazy joke, and it's almost like the Joker. Like, that character, he'd be so good as the Joker.
Right.
But Tony's just like that.
That's a great character. I forgot about that guy.
The best character in the whole place. So but I'm dark. Like, super every time I'm like, that's my fucking business partner. He's just like that. Like yesterday, I'll tell you, Tony, listen to this. So we're having this conversation about Instagram, and I'm just trying to say, We're working out trying to figure out some things with some public relations people. These goddamn people are so useless, and it's just like the prices are so high. And I'm like, I'm doing these new reels and stuff like that. And he just turns
to me.
And
by the way,
I appreciate it. He turns to me and he goes, Instagram, to get a viral video, you just have to get kicked in the balls or show your tits. And I said, is that your suggestion? And he's just like, well, one or the other. And that was the end of that conversation.
Is that what we're going to see this week? I mean, you get kicked in the balls.
He just said it. He said, you're going to bleed, show your tits, or get kicked in the nuts. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I was like, okay, all right, Tony. Take it easy there, kid. So
he's quite true. Quite true, though.
Interesting. Yeah, I've just been watching Sopranos. I was telling Craig about that last weekend.
Yeah. Oh, yes. You said last week.
Yeah, we got to a point. Ralphie. I don't know if you watched Sopranos, Jeff.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Ralph is a piece of shit. I'll tell you what.
They're all pieces of shit. This is what works. I mean, this is what it's no longer everyone's all good or all bad. Everyone's got to be, relatively reprehensible. Sure. That's what makes these shows good. Like all of them. If you look at The Sopranos, if you look at, I've watched two episodes of that fucking Dragon show. And then other things, they're so exciting because it's like you like these people and then they're complete pieces of shit. And you're just like, maybe I like a piece of shit.
Yeah. Actually, I got a question for you, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Because you've traveled over and worked with Tomer a few times now, and you got that coming up soon. I'm going to be over in Ireland. I had a thing that I was trying to do with Fingal and some other collaborators, and it kind of fell through. And I'm trying to decide on doing a class or should we kind of cruise around and or do like a lower key, like just kind of a very relaxed kind of gathering while over visiting Fingal. I actually just got off the phone with him. It was a good conversation. We shot around some ideas, but I haven't really traveled to a foreign country to do any teaching stuff. And I was just, from your experience, what is some advice that you have with the time
you put your
available.
Broadback in the overhead for the
you got to just know your shit. And it translates. You just know what you're organized and you know what I had to the first year I taught with Tomer, I had one guy who didn't speak a lick of English and we had to work it out and it worked out. We worked it out.
Nice.
You just got to know your shit and you got to know exactly what you're going to do and it'll translate.
Yeah.
I would say this is get your jet lag squared away fast. That's one thing because you don't have really the availability to be fucking zonked.
Yeah. I think so. What we're looking at doing is we land just before the weekend, and then it's going to actually be the second weekend that Fingal and I are talking about trying to do some sort of Irish hammering. And I don't know, like, we might try to get people or entice people to come over from, you know, the UK or farther. But I think it would be a cool event. But yeah, I was just kind of trying to get some of your take on traveling and teaching and or demonstrating and stuff like that. I've only done that in the States.
It's the same. It's what do you think? I mean, you think that life works on the euro? I mean, it's the same thing. It'll be fine. It'll be exactly the same. You just got to get your shit together. That's all.
And you know, Fingal's going to have most of the stuff that you need. I know there's a group of them there that, you know, within a stone's throw from Fingal as well. Between them, they'll have everything you'll need there.
Yeah. What are you worried about?
Yeah.
I don't know. Just nervous. I've just never done it before.
What's it?
Abroad.
It's just, they're people.
It's just like all the travel. Yeah. Just, I don't know.
Just don't drink with the Irish. That's probably the best tip we could give you. Don't drink.
I'm
with
part
Fingal
Irish.
And his
I can drink with those guys, can I?
Americans say, you know what? American. We're part Irish.
My great grandmother is Anna Kelly.
They don't give a fuck.
A half a Guinness on St. Patrick's Day.
They don't give a fuck. That's right. This weekend is St. Patrick's Day. I tell you what, when I know I have conversations with Fingal and he thinks it's hilarious. I send him all these. I send him old American Irish commercials like the Shamrock Shake and stuff like that. And he says, "You Americans, you think you're all Irish. None of you are fucking Irish. You're all Americans. Trust me." He didn't say it as coarse as I did, but he's just like this. The hilarious part about, you know, Irish Americans is they think that they're Irish. And fuck that. So.
Yeah, it'll be fine. I mean, you're a good communicator, so you'll be able to communicate what you need to.
I'm also trying to follow that up with, because I'm going to Ireland and then Italy and then back home. So I don't know how that's going to translate in Italy. Hopefully,
you teaching in Italy too?
Yeah, that's the goal. So
just every time you shake someone's hand, you say "cazzo di faccia." Say "cazzo di faccia." They love it. It's the nicest term of endearment of all time. You say "hey, bella donna, cazzo di faccia." So they love that.
And with that, shall we call it a show? Thank you all for listening. We shall be with you again next week. Bye for now.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.